The Myth of Male Power, Why Men Are the Disposable Sex, by Warren Farrow.
Hi, I'm Tom Howard. I've been doing television and radio news and talk shows for close to 20 years now, and one of the most fascinating people I've ever interviewed is the man you'll be listening to on this tape, the author of The Myth of Male Power, Dr. Warren Farrow. Dr. Farrow wanted to do this book on tape as a dialogue rather than a monologue, and I was especially pleased when Simon & Schuster Audio asked me to play interviewer. Let me tell you a little of what is so remarkable and original about this author. He's someone who was on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City almost a quarter century ago, when the women's movement was in embryonic form. Yet he's also someone who was willing to forfeit the lecture fees he was making, speaking on behalf of the women's movement, in order to articulate for men the perspectives he felt the feminist movement had been neglecting. He did this although he knew women bought 85% of the books on relationships, and that the speaking circuit was filled with government money to sponsor feminist speakers, but had no money to sponsor speakers articulating men's perspectives. On the other hand, I think you'll be impressed by the fact that he took 10 years to listen to women's perspectives before he began to speak on behalf of men. Warren Farrell's first book was The Liberated Man. That book, written in 1974, was largely from the perspective of women and feminists. 12 years later, in 1986, he wrote Why Men Are the Way They Are, which took hundreds of questions from women, questions they typically asked about men, such as, why are men afraid of commitment, and answered those questions in a way that allowed women to really hear men's perspectives. Dr. Farrell researched and wrote that book during the early and mid-1980s, years before America heard of a men's movement. Why Men Are the Way They Are became an award-winning national bestseller, called by the New York Post the most important book ever written about love, sex, and intimacy. It's particularly noteworthy that of the more than 600 men's and women's groups he's formed, about half of them have been women's groups. More than 150,000 women and men have attended his workshops, which is doubtless why the Chicago Tribune calls him the glorious Steinem of men's liberation. Warren Farrell has written for the New York Times and frequently appeared in Time and Newsweek. He's been interviewed by Peter Jennings, Barbara Walters, Larry King, and by me. He's appeared 8 times on The Phil Donahue Show, and I've missed him all 8 times, but he's also appeared numerous times on Oprah, 2020, The Today Show, The Tomorrow Show. He has appeared in People, on Real People, and on To Tell the Truth, believe it or not. And now, enter Dr. Warren Farrell. It's time to tell his truth. Warren, right up front, I'm fascinated by this concept you talk about in your book about power. What do you mean by power?
In The Myth of Male Power, what I'm trying to do is redefine what we mean by power. I'm saying power is the ability to control our own life. If we have the ability to control our own life, we have power. If we don't, if we're working for somebody else, if we feel obligated to take a job that we don't like in a coal mine or to become a principal rather than a teacher, and we love teaching, and then we earn more money and like it less, and then we die sooner as a result of stress, and someone else is spending our money while we're dead, I don't call that power.
You point out in your book that men on average die 7 years earlier than women. Are you hoping that one result of this book will give men and women information that will help men live longer?
Definitely. And that means getting men to understand what their feelings are, being able to express those feelings, getting the society to understand that what we're doing that is leading to men being 85% of the homeless, most of the alcoholics, most of the gamblers, 94% of the prisoners, and also most of the victims of homicide and suicide. It's funny, Tom, that we have really very few problems understanding that blacks are more likely to be victims of these problems because of their powerlessness as a group. But when men as a group are victims of each of these problems, we can't conceive that it might be because men have a different form of powerlessness.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Warren, is that I've seen you in front of workshops, I've seen you lecture, I've listened to tapes of yours, I've read your materials, I've read articles that you've written, as well as your books. And I've talked to people who've listened to your tapes and seen your work and read your work, And I've been really impressed the degree to which you seem to be able to get over the barrier to both sexes. I mean, I've heard lots of women say, I'm real impressed with the sense I get that he understands how I feel as a woman, as well as able to explain what's going on with men. And it seems to me that one of the things that you really emphasize in this book is that although you think it's time for us to pay attention to what happens to males as far as powerlessness is concerned, that you are not in any way suggesting that we start denying women's experience of powerlessness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would really be sad if I have to spend 10 years of my life 10 years from now countering people who are in need of, okay, I've understood that men are hurt in these various ways, and now I've, you know, now I'm going to put every woman down that I'm, you know, that I'm involved with. I think, you know, it's really been my whole intent of getting involved in this gender dialogue to from the very beginning was just seeing how the roles that I grew up with were just so unnecessarily limited, and, you know, how the girls that I was with, you know, they didn't have a sense of power and self-confidence.
So you don't think that the old roles were good?
I don't think that they were good by the standards we have today. But I do think that they were functional for survival of the species.
Functional?
Functional for the ability of the species to survive for thousands of years. What I'll be explaining in this tape is why the roles that used to be functional for survival have now become dysfunctional. And dysfunctional in almost an evolutionary instant, which is what's making our transition so tough.
So you'll be taking us from the personal level to a larger societal level.
Yes, and I'll be taking us from looking at the past where the sexes had to be role mates to looking at the future where the sexes, I believe, desire to be soulmates.
On the personal level, what made you so interested in the women's movement for so many years, Warren?
I think first, I can remember seeing my mother be so much happier at times in her life when she had her own source of income, some ability to spend without having to ask my father for money, somewhat like a welfare recipient does to the government. I can remember feeling sad that girls weren't taught to play team sports with us boys. I had a girlfriend who I especially wanted to be playing team sports with me. That they were taught to be prudish about sex. You can understand why I was not liking that. And yet we guys seem to be taught to be sex maniacs. And the whole concept of roles, people having to fit into straitjackets, seemed really sad to me, very confining, and I think really anti-human. The women's movement was the first thing that came along to start questioning what I had been questioning. So I assumed it would be helping both sexes to free themselves.
Warren, how did you feel about the fact that women were more interested in all this stuff than men?
Well, I think the fact that my audiences were about 90% women and about 10% men, most of the men of whom had been dragged there by women, only reinforced my assumption that women were sort of the enlightened sex and men were the Neanderthals, that women were sort of the smart women who were stuck with us guys, the foolish choices.
Well, there must have been some ego gratification to being the country's leading male feminist, no?
Not announced.
I really
secretly loved this perspective. It allowed me, in a sense, to see myself as one of America's sort of sensitive new age guys,
mm-hmm.
Sort of a new Top Gun. And feminists often ask me things like, Warren, how can we clone you? Do you have a brother? What in your background made you so secure? And I have to say that really reinforced my secret pride. And the three or four invitations for new speaking engagements that I would get almost after each new engagement, or after each engagement, allowed me for a lot of financial security.
Well, I would think that's an important point. Financial security usually leads to ideological lockjaw. So what loosened the jaw, so to speak?
I love that phrase, ideological lockjaw. I think what loosened the jaw was reality. As most of the women who were my strongest supporters got divorced, I could only assume that the problem was their husbands. And most of these women agreed that the problem was their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I observed in some of my feminist women friends was that they had something in common. And what they had in common was an increasing anger toward men. an almost a restlessness in their eyes that did not seem to reflect a deeper inner peace. And then I think as I was observing that, one day in one of those, you know, rare moments of internal security that occasionally you get, I asked myself whether whatever impact I might have had was a positive one. And I started wondering if the reason so many more women than men were listening to me was because I had been listening to women but not listening to men. And I reviewed some of the tapes from some of the hundreds of women's and men's groups that I had started. And I heard myself. And when women criticized men, I was seeing that I was calling it insight, assertiveness, women's liberation, independence, high self-esteem. But when men criticized women, I was calling it sexism, male chauvinism, defensiveness, rationalizing, backlash. I think I did it politely, but the men got the point. Soon the men weren't expressing their feelings, and then I found myself, as I was listening to these tapes, I heard myself criticizing these guys for not expressing their feelings right after I was criticizing them when they expressed their feelings.
Then what happened?
After listening to the tapes, I started listening a lot more to men. But then when women asked, why are men afraid of commitment, or feminists said, men have the power, my answer incorporated a different perspective, what I think was both sexes' perspectives. And I noticed that almost overnight, my standing ovation started to disintegrate.
So you found, you must have found that it took more internal security on your own part to be speaking on behalf of men than it had taken to be speaking on behalf of women.
Or more accurately, to be speaking on behalf of both sexes rather than on behalf of only women.
Ah.
And yes, it did take more internal security, and it also took more financial security.
I'll bet.
And there's another side to that. It was women's standing ovations that dropped off, but it was also mostly women who wrote to me that these new perspectives were helping them feel a lot more loving toward their husband, their father, and their men friends.
So once they heard what you had to say, they'd think about it and they'd come back to you.
Exactly. Actually, I remember even one woman walking out of my lecture and then writing me a few weeks later that she ran by the things she objected to her husband, and her husband said he never felt so understood by her before. And so she came back to the lecture a second time to hear it from a different perspective again.
And this was probably what encouraged you to write more about
it. It encouraged me. It was exactly that type of letter that encouraged me to write more. And the women were usually very articulate about saying, put this stuff in writing more. And I didn't like it as much at first. I liked it, but it's helping me a lot more than your praising of women.
Okay, then. Have we been misled by feminists?
Yes, but it is not feminists' fault.
How's that?
Men have not spoken up, and women cannot hear what men do not say. I think that the fault that it's been is the fault of men. Men have to take the responsibility to say what we want, to turn a war in which only one side shows up into a dialogue in which both sexes speak up.
How do we do that?
By not assuming that an audio tape or a book about relationships such as this is for women. Men must take responsibility to end the era of relationship issues as women's issues. Women have contributed a tone, and I think that men must contribute theirs before we're ready for a synthesis.
So is the myth of male power the flip side of feminism?
No. Feminism says the world is patriarchal and male-dominated. The flip side would be the world is matriarchal and female-dominated. I'll be explaining why it's both male and female-dominated in different ways. I would be as strongly opposed to a view that the world is female-dominated as to a view that it's male-dominated because, as I'll try to explain, I believe both are inaccurate.
Warren, are you a men's liberationist, a feminist, both, neither?
Of course. I guess, like everyone else, I'd rather be listened to than labeled. But I'm willing to call myself a men's liberationist or a masculist, quote-unquote, as long as you define men's liberation as equal opportunity and equal responsibility for both sexes. And I'm also a feminist when feminism favors equal opportunity and responsibility for both sexes. And I oppose both movements when either one says, our sex is the oppressed sex, therefore we deserve rights. That to me is not gender liberation, but gender entitlement. So ultimately, I'm really not in favor of either a women's movement or a men's movement. I'm in favor of a gender transition movement. However, I oppose skipping past a men's movement until men have equally articulated our perspective. I think then, and only then, we'll be ready for a synthesis.
Do you see a need for women's studies or men's studies? Or do you take the feminist position that history is men's studies?
I see a temporary need for both women's studies and men's studies. One of the principal functions of women's studies is to question the traditional female role. And I strongly support that questioning of the traditional female role. Nothing, though, that we have now questions the traditional male role in society, least of all history. History is basically something that sells to boys the traditional male role, the male role of hero and performer. Every history lesson tells a boy, if you perform, you'll get love and respect. You'll be seen in these pages. If you fail, you'll be nothing. You'll be invisible. To a boy, history is pressure to perform, not relief from that pressure. Feminism, to its credit, is relief from the pressure to be confined to only the traditional female role. To a boy, then, history reinforces the traditional male role, and therefore, because it reinforces a traditional role, it is the exact opposite of women's studies.
Well, women's studies is also about women's rights, isn't it?
Yes, which is why we also need men's studies. Women's studies tells women that they have the right to what was traditionally the male role. Nothing tells men that men have rights to what was the traditional female role.
Example.
For example, the right for a dad to have equal opportunity to be home with the children while the mother financially supports the children and her husband.
Before we continue the men's portion of gender transition, though, tell me, do you see the feminist movement as being mostly positive or negative?
Actually, I cherish a lot of the contributions to the feminist movement, especially, I think, the way it's done a great deal to pave the way for flexible work schedules. I love the contribution it's made in the area of more flexible child care options. I love the fact that because we care so much about women, we've begun developing much more improved work safety standards than we never had before.
Mm.
When I see girls playing team sports like baseball and soccer, it really moves me to tears because I remember girls in my day didn't have the opportunity to do that. And as a result, they didn't understand how to separate the issue from the friendship. They took things personally. They didn't have a lot of the understandings that many girls today have when they learn to take the tough spots of losing on a team and then winning.
So you cherish the positive parts of feminism, but what about the negative parts?
It made us focus on the fact that working mothers worked more hours inside the home, but no one told us that working fathers worked more hours outside the home. In essence, I guess feminism suggested that God might be a she, but not that the devil could also be a she.
Ah.
It articulated the shadow side of men and the light side of women, but it neglected the shadow side of women and the light side of men. And it neglected to acknowledge that each side, each sex, has both the shadow side and the light side within it.
I know the book and the tape are called The Myth of Male Power, but are there ways that a woman experiences a greater sense of powerlessness than her male counterpart?
Absolutely. For one thing, a woman's smaller size, on average, leaves her with a lot greater fear of being physically overpowered and therefore feeling more vulnerable, especially to rape, to robbery, and to assault. And she's more likely to fear pregnancy, obviously, and date rape and aging. She receives less socialization to take a career that pays enough to support a husband and children, and therefore often feels pressure to marry men who earn more rather than choosing from all the available men. She has less exposure to team sports, with that blend of competition and cooperativeness that team sports creates. We often think of team sports as focusing mostly on competition. In fact, team sports helps a woman know when to compete and when to cooperate.
Well, I suppose women even have the little problems, like less freedom to walk into a bar without worrying about being bothered.
Exactly. And fortunately, most industrialized nations have at least acknowledged these female experiences. The unfortunate part is that the conclusion from all this is that women have the problem and men are the problem. What's missing from that picture is the acknowledgement that men have a different experience. For example, a man who's seen his marriage become alimony payments, or his home become his wife's home, and his children become child support payments for children who have been turned against him psychologically. this man feels he's spending his life basically working for people who hate him. He feels desperate for somebody to love, but he also fears that another marriage might ultimately leave him with another mortgage payment, another set of children turned against him, and a deeper desperation. Then when he's called commitment phobic, this man doesn't feel very understood. When a man tries to keep up with these payments by working overtime, and someone accuses him of coming home late, or being a workaholic, or he tries to handle the stress by drinking, and someone tells him he's a drunkard, he doesn't feel powerful, he feels powerless.
What do you see as the most serious discrimination against men?
Draft registration of our sons, but not our daughters. In post offices throughout the United States, Selective Service posters picture the body of a man with these words written across his body. Register. A man's got to do what a man's got to do. Can you imagine if a post office had a poster saying, a Jew's got to do what a Jew's got to do?
Ouch.
Or if because we register men to be killed off in war, and that's their role, we registered all women to produce male children to replace the men who are killed off in war, and we had Selective Service posters with pictures of pregnant women with these words written across the woman's body. Register. A woman's got to do what a woman's got to do.
Obviously, there would be a few women who would say, a woman's body means a woman's choice.
Exactly. Our slogan for a woman is, a woman's body, a woman's choice. Our slogan for a man is, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. Now, the question to me is this. How is it that if any other group were singled out to register for the draft based merely on its characteristics at birth, be that group blacks, Jews, women, gays, we would immediately recognize it as genocide. But when men are singled out based on their sex at birth, men, we're stupid enough to call it power.
Well, now that women are joining the military, is that making things a bit more equal?
Actually, not. Women have equal rights to join the military, but not equal obligations to register. And once they're in the military, women increasingly have equal rights to fight in combat positions, but do not have equal obligations to be in those combat positions if they're needed.
If the President of the United States were to extend affirmative action, let's say, to the military, what might that look like?
Imagine for a moment music playing in your car radio, and an announcer's voice interrupts, "We have a special bulletin from the President," and for some reason you decide not to switch stations.
Okay.
And the President announces, "Since 1.2 million American men have been killed in war, as part of my new program for equality, we will draft only women until 1.2 million American women have been killed in war." The single biggest barrier to getting men to look within is that what any other group would call powerlessness, men have been taught to call power. We don't call male killing sexism, we call it glory. We don't call the 1 million men who were killed or maimed in one battle in World War I, the Battle of the Somme, we don't call it a Holocaust, we call it serving the country. We don't call those who selected men to die murderers, we call them voters.
If I get this right, what you're saying is that power is the control of one's life. So I guess I'd like to ask you to do two things for me, Warren. First, if you would elaborate on that a bit. And second, could you deal with whether men have the power we think they have in the traditional ways that power has been defined? The power of money, influence, status, that type of power. Could you start here for me with the control of your life power issue?
Sure. In 1920, women in the United States lived 1 year longer than men. Today, women live 7 years longer. We acknowledge that blacks dying 6 years sooner than whites reflects the powerlessness of blacks in American society, yet men dying 7 years sooner than women is rarely seen as a reflection of the powerlessness of men in American society. If power means having control over one's life, then perhaps there's no better ranking of the impact of sex roles and racism combined on power over our lives than the life expectancy figures. I'll give you those figures just for a second. At the top is females, white, average life expectancy 79.
79 years.
79 years, right. Second place is females, black, 74. Males, white, in third place, 72. Males, black, in fourth place, 65.
So men's shorter life expectancy is one example of their powerlessness when power is defined as control over one's life.
Yes, and another is men's greater tendency to commit suicide.
I know men commit suicide about 4 times as often as women, but is that true in all age groups?
No. Until boys and girls are 9, their suicide rates are identical. It's from 10 to 14 that the boys' rate becomes twice as high as the girls, from 15 to 19, 4 times as high, and from 20 to 24, 6 times as high. In absolute numbers, as boys are exposed to the male role, their suicide rate increases 25,000%.
Wow. Well, what about for older men versus older women?
The suicide rate for men over 85 is 1,350% higher than for women over 85.
Astounding. You know, we never hear about those kind of figures. Now, part of control over one's life has to do with being victimized by violence. And we do hear that women have to worry more about being victims of violence than men do. Is that true?
No. Overall, men are almost twice as likely as women to be victims of violent crimes, even when rape is included. And men are 3 times more likely to be victims of murder.
You know, in a sense, Warren, it sounds almost like you're saying men are the invisible victims of violence.
I am. For example, when Rodney King was beaten by police, we called it violence against blacks, not violence against men. But if Regina King had been beaten, I think that a number of people would have mentioned it as violence against women.
Well, before we get to the traditional forms of power, I'm fascinated by these unconscious ways in which men's powerlessness is invisible. Do you have any other examples?
Okay. I don't know if you remember Steve Petrix, a journalist who lived here in San Diego. Every day he returned home to have lunch with his wife. One day, as he got near his door, he heard his wife screaming. She was being attacked with a knife. Steve fought the assailant off, and his wife ran to call the police, and the intruder killed Steve. Steve was playing an invisible role, the role of unpaid bodyguard. We think of men as being violent to women. The invisible role is that we never think of men's unpaid role of being expected to protect any woman we are with any time she might be threatened.
Warren, you know, the subtitle of the book, The Myth of Male Power, is Why Men Are the Disposable Sex. Is this one way in which men are the disposable sex?
Yes, whether it's the expectation of men to be the unpaid bodyguards, or of men to be the sex to register for the draft, or volunteer firefighters, or to be almost 100% of the members of the most dangerous professions, the hazardous jobs. These are just a few of the ways that men are expected to be the disposable sex that we don't recognize, and therefore they're invisible.
Okay, well, let's move on to the traditional forms of power, like who makes the bucks.
Let's get right to the nitty-gritty here. When it comes to money, what counts between the sexes is what women versus men have left when their different expenses and liabilities as a sex are subtracted from their different incomes and assets. So what we really need to get to is net worth. For example, if men make twice as much but are also the sex expected to pay more for child support, alimony, mortgage payments, then it is the net worth, not the gross income, that gives us a sense as to which sex is faring better. Women's average net worth is $14,000. Men's is $10,000. These are U.S. Census Bureau figures, and as with all the figures in this book, the details are in the endnotes of The Myth of Male Power. Put on a percentage basis, women who are heads of households have a net worth 141% that of men who are heads of households.
So you're not saying women have higher gross incomes, but rather that more men are more likely to, for example, support wives than a wife is to support a husband, and therefore that his income is more likely to be divided up.
Yes, and this is especially true after divorce. Divorces often mean that the woman receives the home that the man pays for and also receives the children the man pays for. It's important to note, though, that the woman does have here a time obligation, that is to spend time with those children. And she has an obligation that after divorce that most men do not have. But it is exactly this woman's time obligation that men pay for by going out and earning more. When men earn more to pay for the children and a home that they're not living in, they of course increase their gross incomes to pay for that, but not necessarily their net worth.
And then, of course, if the man and woman start dating, he is more likely to pay and she's more likely to be paid for.
Yes, so he earns more money to pay for the dinner, the theater, the gas, but he also has more spending obligations.
Now, what about the wealthiest people? Aren't they mostly men?
No, surprisingly, the IRS reports that the wealthiest 1.5% of the population, those with assets over $500,000, among those people, women's net worth is also more than men's. As I say, all the documentation for this is in the endnotes of The Myth of Male Power.
How can so many of the wealthiest people be women when women hold almost none of the top corporate jobs?
In part by marrying the men who hold those jobs and living after those men die. Women compete hard for men who compete hard.
Well, if women have more net worth power, so to speak, it would stand to reason that they would also have more buying power, more spending power. Do they?
Yes, they do. A study of large shopping malls, including men's shops and sporting goods stores, found that 7 times as much floor space is devoted to women's personal items as to men's.
I've noticed that.
Both sexes buy more for women. The key to wealth, in a sense, is not in what someone earns, it is what is spent on ourselves, either at our own discretion or what is spent on us at our hint. Overall, women control consumer spending by a wide margin in virtually every consumer category.
Are you implying here that control of consumer spending by women gives women other forms of power?
Yes, it does. When women both spend more and also, as they do, watch more TV in every time slot, shows can't afford to bite the hand that feeds them. Women become to TV what bosses are to employees.
And what's the result of that?
The Oprahs, the Donahues, and all those shows I go on that entertain mostly women by bashing men. And in primetime TV, half of the 250 made-for-TV movies in 1991 depicted women as victims, women subjected to some form of physical or psychological mistreatment, usually by men.
It sounds here, Warren, like what you're saying is that part of male socialization for powerlessness is teaching men to spend more on women.
Yes, a fundamental form of sexism is what I call the spending obligation gap. In restaurants, men pay for women about 10 times as frequently as women pay for men. And the more expensive the restaurant, the more the man tends to pay. Women often say, well, wait a minute, Warren, men earn more. But when 2 women go off to a restaurant, they don't assume that the woman who earns more will pay the bill.
That's a good point.
The expectation on men to spend more on women creates the spending obligation gap.
How do you think this expectation to spend more on women affects men's lives and their personalities? Let's get personal. How did it affect the decisions you made when you were young, Warren?
I think I got a sense of the spending obligation gap as soon as I thought about my first date. As a teenager, I used to love babysitting. I loved kids, but I also, it was the only way I could raid a refrigerator for free.
And get paid.
And get paid and have nobody holler at me. But then I got to the dating age, and alas, babysitting paid only 50 cents an hour, and lawn mowing paid $2 an hour. I hated lawn mowing. I hated the humidity in New Jersey and the bug biting and the noonday sun, and it made lawn mowing a lot less pleasant than raiding a refrigerator. But as soon as I started dating, I started mowing lawns. For boys, I think lawn mowing is a metaphor for the way we soon learn to take jobs that we like less because they pay more. Around junior year of high school, boys begin to repress their interest in foreign languages and literature and art history and sociology and anthropology because we know that an art history major is going to make a lot less than an engineer. And as a result of his different spending expectation, the possibility that he might have to support a woman but can't expect a woman to support him, over 85% of students who take engineering as a college major are men, and over 80% of the people who take art history as majors are women. In brief, what I'm saying then is that the spending obligation that leads a man to choose a career he likes less that pays more is a sign of male powerlessness, not male power. But when he takes that job, women often assume he will pay because, quote, after all, he earns more. Thus, both sexes' expectation reinforce male powerlessness.
Okay, if men have lower net worths and greater spending obligations, Don't they, though, at least have greater influence power?
In business and government, for sure. But let me explain why influence power is not real power. For example, if we told mothers, now listen, Mom, the more children you have, the more power you will have. Most mothers would be intelligent enough to laugh,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
At us. And if we then said, no, the more children you have, the more everyone will love you and respect you, the mother would legitimately understand that she's feeling pressured. She's not feeling empowered.
Mm-hmm.
But when we tell men, the more people you supervise, the more power you have, we buy it. Men, we are really the stupid sex. Men call things power that any woman would be smart enough to call powerlessness. Real power, then, does not come from caving in to pressure to expand our obligations. It comes from deciding what we want to do with our life.
Hmm. But didn't a lot of men at least have the satisfaction of having influence over others, something that women didn't have?
Almost every woman had a primary role in the female-dominated family structure. Only a small percentage of men had a primary role in the male-dominated governmental and religious structures. Many mothers were, in a sense, the chair of the board of a small company, their family. Conversely, most men were on their company's assembly line, either its physical assembly line or its psychological assembly line. While theoretically the man was the master of the house, most men felt they were a visitor in their wife's castle, in the same way a woman would have felt like a visitor had she entered her husband's place of work. From a woman's perspective, a man's home is his castle. From a man's perspective, a woman's home is his mortgage.
You know, Warren, we hear a lot about women working two jobs and men working one. True?
No. Women do work more hours inside the home, but what we don't hear about is the fact that men work more hours outside the home. The average man commutes farther, and he spends more time doing yard work, repairs, and painting. And when all of these are combined, the University of Michigan study reported in the Journal of Economic Literature in 1991 found that the average man worked 61 hours per week, the average woman 56.
So Warren, overall, in the larger picture, this frequent comparison we've heard so much about women to minority groups such as blacks, I would think that you'd say that that's quite off base.
It's very off base, and the off baseness basically started about in the 70s when an article in Psychology Today called Women as Niggers started comparing the situation of blacks to the situation of women. And it got all us feminist activists, myself included, to start comparing the oppression of blacks to the oppression of women. And that was where this comparison started that made use of the gains of the civil rights movement by painting women as victims. Now, it's not that the parallels didn't have a germ of truth, but what none of us realized was how each sex was, historically speaking, the other sex's slave in different ways. And therefore, neither sex was a nigger, because nigger implies that all the slavery is one-sided.
Well, in what way did men have an equivalent experience to blacks or slaves?
Blacks were forced via slavery to risk their lives in cotton fields so that whites might benefit economically, while blacks died prematurely. Men were forced via the draft to risk their lives on battlefields so that everyone else might benefit economically, while men died prematurely.
Ah.
The disproportionate number of blacks and males in war increases both blacks and males' likelihood of experiencing problems like post-traumatic stress, of becoming killers in post-war civilian life, and of dying earlier. Both slaves and men died to make the world free, but it was someone else's freedom.
Uh-huh.
Slaves had their own children involuntarily taken away from them. Men, still today, have their own children involuntarily taken away from them. We tell women they have the right to children, and we tell men they have to fight for children.
In divorce.
Exactly.
Anything else?
Blacks were forced via slavery into society's most hazardous jobs. Men are forced via socialization into society's most hazardous jobs. Both slaves and men used to make up almost 100% of the death professions. Men still do. When slaves gave up their seats for whites, we called it subservience. When men give up their seats for women, we call it politeness. Similarly, we call it a symbol of subservience when slaves stood up as their master entered a room, but a symbol of politeness when men stand up as women enter the room. Blacks are more likely than whites to be homeless. Men are more likely than women to be homeless. Blacks are more likely than whites to be in prison. Men are 16 times as likely as women to be in prison. Blacks die earlier than whites. Men die earlier than women. Blacks are less likely than whites to attend college or graduate from college. Men are still less likely than women to attend college. 46% versus 54%.
Some people are going to be surprised by those figures.
Yes.
But what about in the workplace?
Apartheid forces blacks to mine diamonds for whites. Socialization expected men to work in different types of mines to pay for diamonds for women. Nowhere in history has there ever been a ruling class who was working to afford diamonds they could afford to give to the oppressed in hopes that the oppressed would love them more. Blacks are more likely than whites to volunteer for war in the hopes of earning money to gain skills. Men are more likely than women to volunteer for war for the same reasons. Blacks are more likely than whites to subject themselves to the child abuse of boxing and football in the hopes of earning money, respect, and love. Men are more likely than women to subject themselves to the child abuse of boxing and football, and also with the same hopes. And it would also be very hard to find a single example in history in which a group that cast more than 50% of the vote got away with calling itself the victim. Or an example of an oppressed group which chooses to vote for their oppressors more than it chooses to have its own members take responsibility for running for office.
Uh-huh.
Women are the only minority group that is a majority, the only group that calls itself oppressed, that is able to control who is elected to every office in virtually every community in the country. Power is not in who holds the office. Power is in who chooses who holds the office.
Good point.
Blacks, Irish, and Jews never had close to 50% of the American vote. Women are the only oppressed group, quote-unquote, to share the same parents as the oppressor, to be born in the middle class and upper middle class as frequently as the, quote, oppressor, to own more of the culture's luxury items than the, quote, oppressor, the only, quote, oppressed group whose, quote, unpaid labor enables them to buy most of the $50 billion worth of cosmetics sold each year, the only, quote, oppressed group that spends more on high fashion, brand name clothing than their oppressors, the only oppressed group that watches more TV during every time category than their oppressors.
Well, feminists at one time were comparing marriage to slavery with the female as slave.
It really seems like an insult to women's intelligence to suggest that marriage is female slavery when we know it is 25 million American females who read an average of 20 romance novels per month, often with the fantasy of marriage. So we have to ask whether feminists are suggesting that 25 million American women have enslavement fantasies because they fantasize marriage, and whether this is the reason Danielle Steele is the best-selling author in the world. Never has there been a slave class that has spent a lot of time dreaming about being a slave and purchasing books and magazines that told them how to get a slave master to commit. Either marriage is something different than slavery for women, and it is. It's a ticket to female options. Or feminists are suggesting that women are not very intelligent.
It sounds to me like you're saying that intelligent women have seen that marrying up frees them.
Exactly. I'll be explaining in a little while how the woman married to the successful man has often been the one to free herself to have options that men do not have.
So bottom line, what does all this mean?
By understanding that what we did to blacks was immoral, we were willing to assuage our guilt via affirmative action programs and welfare. By thinking of men and what we did to men as not being consequential and that men are the dominant oppressors who do what they do for power and greed, we feel very little guilt when men die early in the process. By believing that women were an oppressed slave-like class, we extended privileges and advantages to women that had originally been designed to compensate for our immorality to blacks. For women and only women to take advantage of the slavery compensation is its own brand of immorality. For men to cooperate is its own brand of ignorance.
Wow. Well, are you suggesting that men did all this, Warren, because they were more altruistic, loving, and less power-hungry than women?
No. both sexes made themselves slaves to the other sex in different ways.
Well, tell me about that. Why did both sexes make themselves slaves to each other? And what allows us to suddenly be able to question this whole phenomenon?
For thousands of years, most marriages were in stage one. They were survival-focused marriages. After World War II, marriages increasingly flirted with stage two, a self-fulfillment focus. In stage one, most couples were role mates. The woman raised the children, the man's role was to raise the money. In stage two, couples increasingly desired to be soulmates. They could do this only if they were in the middle class, though, and only once their survival needs were met. Then they could up the ante and redefine love.
Redefine love?
Yes. In stage one, a woman called it love if she found a man who was a good provider and protector. He called it love if she was beautiful and could take care of a home and children. Love meant a division of labor, and that division of labor led to a division of male and female interests. In stage two, love can mean common interests and common values. Love's definition, therefore, is in transition.
Well, did women begin redefining love first because they were the most oppressed and the most interested in love?
No. That would suggest that the middle-class women were more oppressed than poor women, and that middle-class women were more interested in love than poor women. Around the world, it was middle and upper-class women who were the best able to redefine love because they were the first group to be free from the preoccupation with survival. But these women got free from preoccupation with survival by being married to successful men.
So weren't these successful men then equally free to focus on redefining love?
No, they were too preoccupied with providing the success.
Oh, okay.
The very success that freed the women.
Right.
That is, they could have protested. But when women chose the type of men who got love and respect by succeeding, they also chose the type of man who was more prone to being a money machine than a loving dad. Ultimately, of course, it is men who must take responsibility for changing this role.
Well, exactly what did the successful man do that freed women?
First, successful men created the technology that allowed women to go from being a baby machine, cooking machine, and a cleaning machine to have time for love. That is, if you think about an 1890s woman, let's say Abigail,
okay,
she had an average of 8 children, statistically. A 1990s woman, say Cindy, has options. She can have no children or 10 children, but typically she had 2 children. She was no longer a baby machine. Abigail, the 1890s woman, cooked meals for 10 people from scratch. She sewed clothes with calloused hands in a house without central heating and without electricity. Cindy could put a pre-prepared meal in a microwave oven and expect help from a dishwasher, a washing machine, a freezer, a telephone, a car, and a 24-hour supermarket. All of this led to a woman's lifespan increasing by almost 50% since 1920.
Well, what did male technology do for men?
It also increased men's lifespan, but not by as much. In 1920, women lived 1 year longer than men. Today, women live 7 years longer than men. Men did a better job creating better homes and gardens for their wives than they did creating safer coal mines and construction sites for themselves. Men went from being a performing machine near the home to being a performing machine away from home. In the process, men were disconnected from their families, from love. And this created in men little deaths every day.
You're saying then that this male technology that's so criticized by the feminist movement in reality led to the male role saving women more frequently than the female role saved men.
Exactly. Feminists sometimes criticized male technology for conspiring to constrict women's reproductive freedom, women's right to choose, for example. But male technology actually created women's right to choose. It created birth control. And it created safe abortions. Birth control for women did more than any other single thing to free women, and it would do more than any other single thing to free men. But men invented the female pill, but no one invented the male pill.
So all of this created a woman with a longer lifespan.
It created a woman who had more options, if she was married to a successful man. For example, when a successful single woman meets a successful single man, they appear on the surface to be equals. But should they marry and consider children, she almost invariably considers 3 options. Option 1, work full-time. Option 2, mother full-time. Option 3, some combination of working and mothering. He also considers 3 options, slightly different options. Option 1, work full-time. Option two, work full time. And option three?
Work full time,
right. Yeah. Or even work overtime or two jobs. So we're living then in an era of the multi-option woman and the no-option man. But remember, the woman only has multiple options if she is married to the successful man. And because women know this, or at least they sense it, this has led to the continuing pressure on men to be successful in order to get female love.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that men have been kowtowing to this pressure rather than protesting it.
Yes, the society will never change until men speak up. But the important thing about women's options is that it allows a woman to tailor-make her life to her personality.
Tell me about that.
Some women prefer a career, some prefer children, some prefer to mix and match either by being full-time involved with the child for a year or two, with or without hired help, and then returning to work part-time for a while, then full-time, then not at all.
All kinds of options.
Exactly. For men, children means just more of the same, intensifying his commitment to the workplace. This allows very little variation to account for a variation in men's personalities. The message to men is basically like it or lump it.
So feminism has not just created equality, it has created more than equality for women.
Yes, had feminism focused on equality, its impact would have been more egalitarian but less politically successful. It would have had to emphasize women's responsibilities, like responsibilities for risking sexual rejection and taking sexual initiatives.
The kinds of things that men have to do all the time, risking rejection whenever they approach women, but women don't.
Exactly. The types of things that turn men into the jerks because they do the initiating too quickly or they don't do it soon enough and they appear like a wimp. That type of responsibility.
What other kinds of responsibilities?
The responsibility for saying to women, you must not just pay for men's dinners by option, but pay for men's dinners by obligation as often as men pay for your dinners. Or women, you should expect yourself to marry down economically as often as you marry up economically. Or women, choose careers that you like less to support the family more so that you can marry a man who's earning less who can support you lovingly. These things would have been far more egalitarian.
Because that would have emphasized the responsibilities as well as the options.
Precisely. It would have emphasized responsibilities, not just rights. But by emphasizing responsibilities, many women would have backed off and the movement would have been less politically successful.
If all these things were benefiting women, why did women become so angry at men?
Because the women married to successful men started to want from these men things that they didn't have, like time. Time to love. Time to come home early and pay attention to them. Vulnerability. In order to become successful, you can't be too vulnerable. Sensitivity. Characteristics which, if a man had these characteristics, they would have, as a rule, prevented him from being successful and therefore have prevented these women from marrying them and being able to up the ante.
Sounds like a double bind for men.
It really is.
So when the women did not get these things from men, they became angry.
Yes, but that was just the beginning. The anger led to women initiating divorces. Two-thirds of divorces are initiated by women.
Two-thirds?
Uh-huh. And it was divorces that really created the anger.
How's that?
Divorce dumped women, and here's where I really feel for women. It dumped women into the workplace without workplace skills.
Uh-huh.
And it dumped women into the marketplace of men who were addicted not to a 40-year-old woman with two children, but to two 20s.
So that men wanted two 20-year-olds instead of a... I see. Well, I can see where some women would get angry about all that.
Yes, and feminism grew politically by adding to this anger.
By feeding off the anger.
Exactly. It explained to women that women, you're segregated into these lower-paying and meaningless jobs. Without saying, wait a minute, women, men are also segregated into jobs, hazardous jobs, the death professions. Feminism was so powerful it blinded women to the men around them who were also segregated into different types of lower-paying, meaningless jobs. The short-order cook, for example, the dishwasher in a local coffee shop, the migrant workers who picked up the vegetables that were on her table, the custodians and car washers, the busboys, the gas station attendants.
The invisible men.
Exactly. And by being blinded to these men, she missed the whole picture, the larger picture. that when either sex had minimal skills, they commanded minimal wages in different types of meaningless jobs. By being blinded to this larger picture, she became increasingly angry.
Well, did the anger also come from the fact that men as a group earn more than women as a group?
Yes. Simultaneously, feminists focused on the fact that women as a whole earned less without focusing on any of the 13 major reasons why women earn less. For example, full-time working men work 9 hours per week more in the workplace than full-time working women. So, of course, the workplace pays those men as a group more. Men are more willing to relocate to undesirable locations like Alaska to work less desirable hours. By calling the difference in pay discrimination and not explaining the reasons for the difference, women were left angry rather than empowered. Had they known the reasons for the difference, they would have been empowered to make up the difference.
What do you think was the most important misrepresentation that feminism perpetrated, leading to an unnecessary increase in anger among women?
Feminism encouraged women to interpret men's tendency to earn more for different work as an outcome of male dominance rather than as a symbol of male subservience.
Subservience.
Exactly. They didn't see it as an outcome of male obligation, the obligation to go where the money was, not where the fulfillment was. For a man, following money was primary, following fulfillment was secondary. For him, divorce also created a change. He still followed money to support a family economically. After divorce, he had no family to support him emotionally.
Well, in your view, Warren, are men doing anything other than being silent about this?
They're doing what most silent people do. They're becoming passive-aggressive. Rather than confronting the female anger, men are increasingly feeling that their only form of relationship power is not getting into a relationship. In my opinion, this is really sad for both sexes.
It puzzles me, Warren, that men would be neither changing nor speaking up about this.
Divorce has led to women changing because divorce has changed women's source of income. It changed it from men only to some combination of men and work. Divorces did not lead to men changing because divorces only increased the pressure on men to focus on income. It led to millions of men taking on 5 payments that are rarely assessed to women. After divorce, men often take on child support, mortgage payments on a home that they no longer live in, apartment rental, alimony, and dating. This led to men doing more of the same and therefore being more of the same. Men didn't complain because the very core of male socialization is when the going gets tough, the tough get going.
That's so true. And sometimes I wonder how much women understand the degree to which we as men feel the very essence of who we are involves not complaining.
Mm-hmm.
So both sexes are in transition, but women, it sounds like, are handling the transition better.
Yes, divorce leaves women with the primary fear of economic dependence and men with the primary fear of emotional dependence, even though both sexes experience an increase in both types of dependencies. But it's much easier for the government to help women economically than it is for the government to help men emotionally. It is easier for the government upon divorce to require the man to give the woman money than to require the woman to give the man emotional love or sexual love.
You mean there's no bill in Congress to subsidize prostitution?
Right. At least I haven't noticed that as part of Hillary's health plan.
Do you have much hope for the future between the sexes?
Yes, I do, because this is really the first time in human history that the qualities it takes to survive as a species are compatible with the qualities it takes to love. In the past, choosing the killer male led to the survival of the fittest. In the future, with nuclear technology, choosing the killer male leads to the potential destruction of everyone. So what was functional has become dysfunctional.
And choosing the killer male was not compatible with choosing a loving male.
Correct. In the past, men had to be cut off from their feelings, or they would not have been willing to die to protect the family and the community. So women had to fall in love with people who were inherently incapable of loving. In the future, women can afford to fall in love less and less with the killer protector and more with the nurturer connector. In the past, survival, marriage, and the family all required the killer male. in the future, survival, marriage, and the family will all require the communicative male.
You said that what was functional has become dysfunctional. How does that relate to the whole idea of dysfunctional family?
Completely. We often think of our parents, what therapists call our family of origin, as dysfunctional. I think it would be more accurate and also more compassionate to call our parents stage one functional.
Tell me about that.
For example, when divorce would have led to starvation, societies were forced to make divorce a taboo. So since a family had no option but to work together, codependency was viable. It was stage one functional.
So what changed?
The ability of men to create technology that allowed people to get beyond starvation problems, allowed people to have the freedom to say, is my husband somebody who's paying attention to me? Is this really love? Which allowed women to initiate divorces, which allowed for divorces. And then divorces forced women and men to say, wait a minute, I have to prepare myself not to be codependent, but to be independent.
So once divorces became allowed, codependency was no longer functional.
Precisely. Now, in stage two, codependency has become dysfunctional. But not understanding this has led us to blaming our parents rather than crediting our parents with having worked so hard to create the conditions that allowed us to ask the questions like, are we communicating? Are we listening? Are we loving each other? Our parents couldn't afford to listen because if our fathers listened to their feelings, they would say, I don't want to work at this type of job to get 10 children through a depression.
But what our fathers and those so-called dysfunctional families of the past that we were blaming, what they were actually doing, in their view, was teaching us survival skills.
And they were teaching us survival skills for their time, and even for our own time, because if a Great Depression comes again, or a recession comes again, we're going to need those survival skills of cutting off from our feelings in order to survive first. Feelings, depression, things like that, they are luxuries of people who have taken care of their survival skills.
It sounds like you feel, Warren, that we've been unnecessarily blaming our parents and blaming men.
We've been blaming, ironically, both groups that have freed the world to be able to go beyond survival concerns and get into doing things like we're doing today. Going down the road in a car, listening with this technology to a tape that gets us to think more in a refined and loving way about the world.
And there's something about a non-blame approach that you think is also beneficial as we move into stage two.
A non-blame approach, I would not suggest if there was really a need for blame. However, it's wonderful when there isn't a need for blame because a non-blame approach is also extremely therapeutic. A blame approach is very non-therapeutic.
You talk about in your book, I think, about a non-blame approach allowing us to become much more loving and accepting and moving from stage one to stage two in a way that makes life more fulfilling for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Instead of having the war of a women's movement, then the war of a men's movement, we have the option of a gender transition movement where we're all looking inside of ourselves and saying, yep, we're stuck in the past that was functional for our parents, and we have an opportunity. We should be celebrating in a way we've never celebrated before. For the first time in human history, we have the option to love each other. And what are we doing? We're spending 25 years blaming men. That's sad.
I think I hear you saying that in stage two, successful men have freed women but forgotten to free themselves, and that in stage one, both sexes were slaves in different ways. Okay, what about the feminist claim that women were treated as property?
Women were treated as property. What the feminists missed, though, was the understanding that men were treated as less than property.
Less than property.
That is, that men were expected to die before their property was hurt. They were expected to protect their property before themselves. If a woman committed a crime under English law, the man went to jail. Feminists never told us about that. Even if a woman spent too much in running her home, her responsibility, it was the man who went to debtor's prison.
Why was property often passed down through men and not through women?
Property was passed down through men because men were not worthy of a woman until they had property. It was the man's responsibility to provide the property.
So providing property was a sign of obligation not a privilege.
Yes, but this did not mean that men had more obligation in the larger picture than women did. Women had the obligation or the responsibility to provide for the children. Neither sex had rights. That's been the misunderstanding of the last 25 years, that the sexes were expected to have rights. Both sexes, in fact, had not rights but obligations and expectations, and if they fulfilled those expectations and obligations, they received status and privileges. The status and the privileges were the bribes to get people to fulfill their obligations.
In other words, they got status for being subservient?
Essentially, yes. For example, men got the status of being a hero for being a good servant. The very word hero, interestingly enough, comes from the Greek sero, S-E-R-O-W, from which comes our word servant, as well as our word slave, and as well as our word protector. And that's almost perfect because that's what a hero was, basically a slave whose purpose was to serve and protect.
Mm.
To protect the community in general was part of his job, and also to protect women and children in particular. In exchange, heroes received the respect and love of those that they protected. But appreciation is a tricky thing. Just as appreciation we gave our mothers for cooking kept our mothers cooking, so the money and the medals that we gave men kept them slaves to their role as heroes. In some respects, appreciation keeps a slave a slave.
Was it mostly in war that men were the disposable sex or less than property?
Mostly, but definitely not exclusively. Historically, men have been the beasts of burden, whether it was building pyramids or the railroad tracks across America in which thousands of men died, so that the rest of us could basically be served dinner in a dining car.
Uh-huh.
In almost every country and every century, men were not thought of as property or animals. They were just used that way. The 15th century Incas did not have horses to speed messages over long distances up and down their mountain paths, so they used men. They paid the money that fed their families when the men died.
But wait a minute, weren't these rules made by men?
These rules were made actually by the needs of survival. The rules were technically made by men, but what does it say about men that they made rules to sacrifice themselves for their families? The rules were made not to serve men's needs, but to serve the needs of survival.
Survival of the whole group.
Exactly, men, women, and children. And what served the needs for survival was reinforced by both sexes. Women inside the home, men outside the home, both reinforced it.
In our own country, though, here in the United States, haven't women been more the second-class citizens than men?
That's been the theory, but it's not correct. Both sexes have been second-class citizens in different ways. During the Civil War, for example, there were two groups that were able to avoid the draft: females and upper-class males. Any female was the equivalent of an upper-class male in this respect, except that even the upper-class men had to buy their way out of death. Some upper-class men could do this by paying $300 to a poor man. This allowed the poor man's family to survive, while about 500,000 poor men were killed in the Civil War. So in total, 623,000 men during the Civil War were killed, the equivalent of 11 Vietnam Wars. Try to imagine 11 Vietnam Wars in a row in which only women were drafted and killed.
Wow. But wait a minute. One of the things that I hear so often from women, Warren, is that war is a man's thing, that men are the ones who create war.
It was the man's role. But, for example, even upper-class men in the South rarely ran ads for substitutes because, as the award-winning series on PBS explained, the women wouldn't permit it. In both the North and the South, women hissed at men who wouldn't fight. And even today, when men try to avoid war, both sexes still metaphorically hiss and boo. You can ask Dan Quayle, you can ask Bill Clinton.
Okay.
And yet no one booed when Geraldine Ferraro avoided war.
So a man has a strong push to try to become a hero. Is this involvement of women supporting men to fight true historically and across different cultures?
Absolutely. There are no enduring legends that I'm aware of in which the beautiful princess falls in love with the conscientious objector.
Okay.
She falls in love with a prince who can provide for her or a warrior who can kill for her. Both the killer and the prince were protectors. The deeper purpose of violence against men was to prevent violence against women. Both sexes prepared boys and men through everything from circumcision to games to endure pain, to deny pain, and to continue protecting until they died.
So were women always falling in love with men who were invulnerable?
No, they were falling in love with men who appeared to be invulnerable.
Ah.
In fact, though, the ability to kill always requires the vulnerability of being exposed to being killed. The irony of male eligibility is that it's created by vulnerability that is masked as invulnerability. And to this day, that's the male tragedy.
Okay, but Warren, tell me, what incentive do women have to give up this power of having a class of people called men brainwashed into protecting them and at the same time being fool enough to call it power?
No incentive. No, actually, there are two incentives.
Okay.
First, when males are expected to protect women with their strength, the risk is that the very strength that protects them in one instance can be used against them in another. And second, the disconnection from feelings that is required to be willing to be shot at on the battlefield or hurt on the football field does not a loving man make.
Okay.
Thus, the athletes for whom women cheer are also the athletes that are involved in one-third of the campus sexual assaults.
You're suggesting that we are still preparing men to be disposable.
Very much so. Think of football, boxing, wrestling, ice hockey, rodeos, auto racing.
Yeah, well.
Probably better as auto crashing, right? Yet the U.S. Senate is proposing to make violence against women a hate crime at the same time that we are calling violence against men entertainment. The most attractive girls in almost every high school still cheer for violence against men. They even give their love in exchange for men being violent unto themselves. They give their love to the boys who play Smash Face the best.
Smash Face.
Yes.
Smash Face, I assume you mean football.
Exactly. That's the place in which they do their Smash Face. Basically, you can think of junior high school football especially as taxpayer-subsidized child abuse.
Child abuse?
Well, maybe more accurately, taxpayer-subsidized boy abuse. Every one of us who pays taxes contributes money to subsidizing this boy abuse and pacifies ourselves by calling it education. If we encourage girls to get male approval by risking spinal cord injuries, enduring concussions, and damaging their knees for life, no one would have trouble recognizing it as subsidizing violence against women. When girls do it, we abhor it. When boys do it, we cheer for it.
Very simply, you're saying that we celebrate violence against men.
Yes. Think of how we name football teams after violent societies. Vikings, Aztecs, Trojans, or fierce animals. Tigers, bears, panthers. Even our cars are called Jaguar, Cherokee, Cougar, Fury, Stealth. Just imagine for a moment your daughter being picked up by a guy driving a Ford Fairy. Or a Dodge Daisy or a Plymouth Pansy.
Okay.
If you're getting into this, just imagine a grown man rooting for a team named not the Giants, but the Munchkins. And not the Atlanta Braves, but the Atlanta Sensitives.
Cute. Okay. But tell me this. Almost all of us cheer for male violence in these kinds of situations. Why is that?
That's a really crucial question. The answer is because, quote, our team winning really meant our society protected.
Ah.
The loss of a man had to be risked to prevent the loss of a society.
Tell me this. Do you think that male violence is inherent?
If men were inherently violent, there would be no need to create a social structure bribing men to be violent. Fortunately, when three conditions are met, men quickly become nonviolent.
Okay, I'll bite. What are the three conditions?
I'm really glad you asked. First, the society has to have adequate food. It has to have adequate water, and it has to be isolated from attack.
Examples.
During various times in their history, these conditions prevailed in Tahiti, in Manoa on Crete, and among the central Malaysian Samai. When men were not needed to kill, women did not reward the warriors with love, and men did not try to obtain love by killing. This was neither women's fault nor men's fault. It was the fact that killing at that point was needed to survive.
So the historians who've been suggesting that matriarchal societies were superior because men and women worked in partnership, those historians are avoiding the fact that partnership was not a result of matriarchy, but a result of unthreatening conditions?
Yes. When there was plenty of food and water and no threat of attack, men didn't have to be killing, they didn't have to be off killing, so they could be part of a partnership at home. It's false to call that patriarchy or matriarchy. It was just different survival conditions.
Wait a minute. Aren't these historians calling it matriarchy because, for example, female gods were primary and not male gods?
Male gods were primary when protection was the primary need. They were not primary when protection was not the primary need. The sad part about this matriarchal labeling is that it makes male sacrifice look like male dominance and makes peace and partnership look like the responsibility of women, rather than the outcome of adequate food and adequate water and a good defense provided at the sacrifice of men.
Okay. About how long do you think it takes for men to go from violent to nonviolent?
Men adapt amazingly quickly when we give them different approval cues. It didn't, for example, take the Japanese men very long to turn swords into stock shares. During World War II, we thought of the Japanese man as extremely violent. Now we think of the Japanese man as much more peaceful.
Feminists say that empire building is proof of male greed and male violence, male aggressiveness.
Both sexes have greed and aggressiveness as their shadow side. Both sexes needed greed in order to access a short supply of food at certain times. But there are two important things to know about empires. First, empires were to countries what insurance policies are to individuals. They were a source of security, both to stave off attack and to have access to food and raw materials in the event of famine or war. Second, we all complain about the killing that men do, and then we choose to live in countries like the United States, which was created as a result of the killing men did. Men died for property. Women often live on the property that was their husband's grave. Major powers became major powers by the death of boys.
We often hear that women are nature's civilizing balance.
By taking care of the killing for women, it could be said that men civilized women.
Wow. That's a fascinating way of conceptualizing this whole thing. Let's deal with the issue of self-esteem. Feminists like Gloria Steinem, for example, in her recent book, Revolution from Within, say that women were second-class citizens in the sense of being the sex that developed low self-esteem.
Both sexes learned to define as high self-esteem something which was really a high degree of conformity, the opposite of what we today think of as self-esteem.
Conformity to what society
needed, exactly, right. Spartans, for example, if they were preparing for war, they removed the boys from the home at the age of 7. They put the boys through a desensitization to feelings, to flogging so fierce that a lot of them died in the process. Now, preparing a boy to die at the age of 7 does not create in him high self-esteem. In stage 1, we gave both sexes status and appreciation in exchange for making themselves subservient, a slave to roles that were necessary to perpetuate the species. That's a very different definition of self-esteem than we think of today, about having a high amount of internal security that would have allowed people to be in touch with their feelings, that would have prevented them from being slaves and subservient to certain roles.
What about the argument that polygyny, one man having many wives, was an example of women as men's property?
Polygyny was a system by which the rich man, by having more than one wife, prevented a woman from being stuck with a poor man. The person who was deprived was actually the man who was poor. He was deprived of love, in essence, because he couldn't afford a woman. perhaps the ultimate example of polygyny is among nuns, all of whom, as you know, quote, marry Christ. While Christ assumes the protection of many women, the nuns take vows of celibacy. Polygyny is often thought of as a way of giving men lots of sex, but Christ's wives would not have been celibate if polygyny's primary purpose was the satisfaction of male sexual desires. Polygyny's primary purpose was, in fact, female protection by the best male saviors. Christ was the best of the saviors. Priests were the human manifestation. Priests provided protection without sexual demands. They provided the ability to listen to women without burdening her with having her have to listen to him.
If all of this protection, Warren, this protection of women, is so built into our psyche, should we even be trying to change it?
Conservatives say this is the way it was in the past and this is the way it should be in the future. I say no. The important question is not, is it natural, but is it functional? If a baby is born naturally with a handicap, we don't say, listen, baby, your handicap is natural. We'll teach you to increase it. But that's basically what we do with men's aggressiveness and women's passivity. That division was functional in the past, but now, for the first time in human history, both sexes have the opportunity to be both full human beings. In fact, the only way we will survive is by not training men to be killers and by training women to be independent enough to not be dependent on the killer protector who, with nuclear technology, will really be the killer destroyer.
Aside from violent sports and the male-only draft registration, in what other ways are men, as you say, being prepared for disposability?
The death professions are all almost 100% men.
By death professions, I'm assuming you mean hazardous jobs.
Yes. Jobs like lumberjack, truckers, construction worker, jobs that lead to 94% of occupational deaths occurring to men. Few people are aware that every day almost as many men are killed at work as were killed during the average day in Vietnam.
So when we heard from feminists that women were being segregated into all the worst jobs, we didn't hear from them that men were being segregated into the death professions.
Yes. However, feminists like myself were also not accurate when we said that women were segregated into all the worst jobs.
Tell me about that.
For example, when the jobs-related almanac ranked 250 jobs from best to worst based on a combination of salary, stress, work environment, outlook, security, physical demands, they found that 24 of the 25 worst jobs were almost all male jobs.
Some examples?
Truck driver, sheet metal worker, roofer, boiler maker, lumberjack, carpenter, construction worker or foreman, construction machinery operator, football player, welder, millwright, iron worker. Each of the jobs I just mentioned have one thing in common, 95 to 100% men.
And you're saying these are not just hazardous jobs, but jobs that have the worst of everything, from salary to stress to outlook for security and so on. Why are professions like this so likely to have such a high percentage of men?
Remember what we said about men having higher gross incomes but lower net worth because, for example, while the woman might have the burden of caring for three children, the man is more likely to have the burden of supplying the income for those three children and himself and his wife. So he's more likely to have a job that will take care of providing the income for all those people.
A job under desperate situations.
Exactly. Just as women are more likely to get up at 3 a.m. to breastfeed a crying baby, a man is more likely to drive a truck at 3 a.m. to provide the rest of the food for that crying baby.
When you suggest the death professions pay more as a sort of death professions bonus, I think you call it, are you also implying that jobs with high percentages of females tend to pay less because of more desirable conditions?
Professions that have 85% or more females have in common 7 of 8 characteristics, what might be called the female occupation formula. What is common to these 8 characteristics is 2 things. One is they are desirable, and second, because they're desirable, they're much in demand, and because a lot of people want them, employers can afford to pay less.
I think it's probably my job to ask you here what these 8 characteristics are.
We'll make you into the thinking person's Ed McMahon here.
Thanks. I noticed you didn't say the thinking man's Ed McMahon.
Oh, politically correct in spite of myself. Anyway.
Okay, but you're not going to get away with this. You haven't forgotten those eight characteristics, right?
Okay. Here goes. First, the ability to psychologically check out at the end of the day. For example, a department store clerk can check out. A lawyer can't.
Not taking the job home with you.
Exactly. Physical safety. A receptionist, more likely to be female, has physical safety versus a firefighter.
Okay.
Indoors. Secretary, indoors. Garbage collector, male, outdoors. Desirable hours or flexible hours. A nurse has more desirable hours, more likely to be female. Medical doctor, more likely to be male, less desirable hours. No demands to move out of town or else, and that is to move it or lose it. Corporate secretary doesn't have a demand to move out of town. Corporate executive does.
Which is why IBM used to be called
I've been moved, right?
Okay.
What a team.
Thanks. But you're not going to get away with leaving out those other two.
Okay. The seventh and eighth desirable characteristics are, seven, high fulfillment relative to training, like a woman who's a child care professional versus a man who's a coal miner.
Okay.
Most people would say the child care professional has a little bit more fulfillment. Contact with people in a pleasant environment is the eighth.
Okay.
For example, restaurant hostess versus long-distance trucker.
So it's a myth, then, that women are segregated into the worst jobs.
Yes, it's a myth. The worst jobs are almost all male jobs, which men take more of because, on the average, they have more mouths to feed.
Well, when it comes to these hazardous jobs, is there an effort to make them as safe as possible?
No. The United States has only one job inspector for every six fish and game inspectors. We have a worker death rate 3 to 4 times higher than Japan's. If we had the same rate, we would save the lives of about 6,000 men and 400 women each year. Or put another way, we kill about 6,000 men and 400 women each year unnecessarily as a result of our lack of attention to work safety.
Many people are going to find that this is the first time they've ever heard this kind of thing. Well, why do we hear so little about the plight of these men?
Partially because men don't speak up, and partially because the location of men's work. Think about the garbage man. He's outside. You don't go up to the garbage man, ask him his name, and say to him, you know, what's your life like? What's your experience with women like? If you didn't go up to your secretary and talk to her a little bit as a person and ask her a little bit about what her experience of men was, you'd be considered a sexist. You'd be considered aloof. You'd be considered arrogant. So we find out a little bit about our secretary's experience with men, but not about our garbage man's experience with women.
Mm.
And that's partially because the location of men's labor is so frequently distant. It's outside the home. It's logging. It's trucking. We don't stop the logger or the truck driver or the construction worker and ask him about his experience of the world.
You know, Warren, that reminds me of something else that I've heard you say, that when a woman meets a doctor, we often overhear her say to her woman friends, I met this wonderful doctor. But we rarely hear a woman say to a woman friend, I met this wonderful garbage man.
Yes, the garbage man is much more likely to be invisible in her life, invisible to her, and she doesn't seek him out. She really doesn't see him.
What are the consequences of these second-choice men being invisible?
We hear, for example, of things like the glass ceiling, women's experience of discrimination. But we don't hear about men's experience of discrimination because no one talks to these men, no one sees these men, no one hears these men, so we don't hear about the equivalent of the glass ceiling, what I would call the glass cellar.
The glass cellar. What does that mean?
Meaning the invisible barrier that keeps men in 24 out of the 25 worst jobs. And these are what I call the glass cellar jobs.
In the book version of The Myth of Male Power, you take the reader on a trip around your neighborhood to make the experience of these invisible men more visible. Can you take us on that trip here?
Okay, let me try to. I remember I had just finished researching how about 70% of the garbage collectors in the city of San Diego, where I live, suffered job-related injuries in the past year alone. And as I was finishing the work on that,
mm-hmm.
I heard the roar of the garbage truck go by my house. And for the first time in my life, when I went out to take the garbage out, because I, typically speaking, don't do it until I hear that roar, I actually allowed myself to look in the face of the man picking up the garbage. And it wasn't until 2 or 3 weeks later that I allowed myself to talk to him, to make connection with him as a human being. And then I was starting to see things that I had never seen before. I saw a lumbar support belt he was wearing, which reminded me of his disproportionate chances for back injuries that I had read about, hernias, rectal cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, or just plain being hit by a passing automobile.
Many people have no idea how much hazard there is in that profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this recalled to me the story of a garbage collector that I had just finished reading about named Terry Hennessy. And this is, by the way, a real story.
Uh-huh.
He had been compacting trash in San Diego, and several plastic bags of human blood splattered into his face while he was compacting the trash.
Wow.
And just a few weeks later, he found a World War II hand grenade with a pin in it. Well, it's pretty hard to find a hand grenade without a pin in it, I guess. And some months later, Terry picked up a load of radioactive waste. His colleagues tell similar stories. One of them tells the story of battery acid splattering on their clothes and faces, and of the compacting process forcing chlorine to shoot out of a container, setting a man on fire.
Wow.
Others tell of experiences of hot fireplace ashes being dumped into the trash and igniting the back of a truck, or of liquid cyanide spilling over them.
Why don't we hear about any of this?
In part because these men never speak up. They tend to turn each other's misfortune into humor. If they have an experience with cyanide, they start calling each other the cyanide man or the radioactive man or so on. And the result is I never felt for these men because I never really heard anything about what they were feeling.